Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the ETHub weekly newsletter, which covers the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we'll be discussing the news from March 11th to March 17th. Hey, Anthony, want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric. Sure. So first bit of news for the week, it's more of a kind of a special news that I wanted to highlight this week, was that the Moloch DAO website is now live. So this project's being headed up from a few different people in the community. Most visible being Amin Soleimani. We've spoken about him before. I'm pretty sure we've spoken about Moloch as well before. So this is basically a new funding initiative where various people can commit funds, get some voting rights, and then the funds get dispersed out to different projects. There's a bunch of game theory at play in here. It's not too complex, but it gets pretty deep when you start thinking about it, as DAOs do. So I linked a few resources in the newsletter. So if you'd like to check out and learn more about Moloch DAO, definitely go check that out. And so far, $275,000 or 2,200 ETH around about has been pledged with 22 founders to support this initiative. So it's really cool to see this the website officially live, which you can go visit at molochdao.com. And play around with it. The UI is mostly functional at the moment. It has a few bugs in it still, but it's still early days. So I don't think it's open yet for people to submit their own proposals. I think you have to go through one of the members that are already, one of the founders. So if you go to Moloch's Twitter, you'll be able to see the founders, the publicly known founders anyway, because a few of them are anonymous. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the SEC chairman affirms Ether is no longer a security. Now, this was quite big news that stirred up the Twitter hive this week. But yeah, so this is the second person from the SEC to kind of come out and say, yeah, we don't think Ether is a security, which was pretty cool. And it kind of begs the question of if these things oscillate, right? So can you go from centralized to decentralized back to centralized? Like, it's a bit weird when you think about it. Maybe, a project starts centralized, gets a lot of hype and activity around it, goes decentralized. I mean, I don't even know how you measure those things, right? There's a bunch of different metrics you can measure it on, but there's nothing concrete and it's kind of a spectrum. But I haven't seen anything, go back to centralized, if you know what I mean. It's a weird thing, because if it goes back to centralized, does it become a security then? And then do exchanges have to treat it like a security? It's really weird. So it's good to see another SEC person come out and say something about it, but it's really weird to think about the implications of it at the end of the day. And I'm hoping for more regulatory clarity, but I don't think anyone expects anything concrete from the SEC or any other regulatory bodies for a while, considering how slow they've been so far.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff's all still a pretty big gray area. I agree. I mean, it'd be nice to get some more clarity around this stuff. But I guess it's just reaffirming, what we assume to this point, that Ether is not a security, but it's great to see it twice now. I wonder how long until this starts being brought up on Twitter over and over again like it was for the last year. But I guess this is just kind of finally putting another nail in that coffin, which is good. It's kind of weird that because it's such a gray area, people don't really know, any day could the SEC come out and just be like, hey, we think, XRP is a security or whatever it might be. It kind of seems like they're trying to stay away from it. I think it probably has a lot to do with how large these projects have got and how much of an uproar it would cause to declare something a security. I mean, you'd be wiping away a lot of value in declaring something a security, and that would hurt a lot of investors at this point, right? So my hunch is they're probably trying to catch projects early on to declare them, or they seem to be kind of going after some of the ICOs that were straight scamming people out of money too. Like that seems to me to at least be where their focus is now, and then just kind of giving some hints here and there on the security side.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the kind of harm that it's brought to investors from these sorts of schemes, and how it's better to catch it early than when it's basically been around for a few years and there's a lot of different people involved. If you look at Ethereum, if if the SEC was to say, yep, Ether's a security, these exchanges have to delist it unless they're registered to sell securities. You know, maybe the EF has to refund people. It gets really, really messy. And I don't think that the SEC's mandate, from what I understand, is that they're there to protect investors. Now, I don't think classifying Ether as a security protects anyone. I don't think anyone would complain if they bought Ether at the ICO, which I think ICO price was about 30 cents. I don't think anyone would be complaining about their investment, you know, even if they held all the way to $1,000 and held it all the way back down to $80, you know, they're still in profit. They have never been in a loss. I think it hit market at like, you know, a dollar or something, or I mean, I wasn't around back then, but looking back at the chart, so I don't think anyone has cause to complain there. So I think the SEC would have a very hard case finding anyone that would want to go after the original Ethereum kind of people that were part of the ICO. And it also begs the question about things like, I mean, everyone always jokes about XRP being a security because it's quite centralized. But unfortunately, XRP has now been around for quite a while. So there are a lot of different holders, a lot of different people that would be affected by this in a negative way. So is it, you know, is it more positive just letting XRP be and not classifying it as a security because it's too far gone now? Which to me just seems very odd, because it just says that if you can escape regulation long enough, or if you can escape the SEC long enough, then you're fine because you've infected, I guess, enough people with your coin that the SEC would cause more damage than, by classifying something as a security than just letting it be, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be the approach we're taking. I guess the other thing I always think about this is, like, we're all super connected and into kind of our crypto as a whole echo chamber. I mean, in reality, like, how big is a $10 billion crypto to like the SEC in the scheme of things, right? It's all still pretty small potatoes. So like, it might not even be coming across their desk as being that important, right? That might be one of the things at play here. So then potentially as we go through another bubble and these things get bigger and bigger as far as market cap goes, maybe that's when the microscope gets turned up a little bit. But then again, now you've been around for, you know, 10 years at that point or whatever it might be, and you have a lot of people invested, that kind of coming out with regulations at that point would hurt. So definitely interesting. I still stand by it. I kind of think they're just going to let these get by, the ones that have been around for a little while, and then kind of put out some stronger guidance for potential future new coins or ICOs or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think the new coins or new protocols are the ones that, you know, have to be worrying at this stage. I don't think the EF would be losing sleep over this sort of stuff, just because it's been so long. And, you know, it's pretty obvious to anyone, not just the people in the weeds, that Ethereum is quite decentralized. You know, if you turn your kind of bias off for a second, objectively, it's quite decentralized. And I mean, as I said, very hard to measure these things, but from the basic metrics that we have, I think it hits all of those quite well. Cool. So enough on the SEC for now. More drama, of course, in crypto. Tether updated their website, and now it says that Tether is not backed by fiat, 100% fiat. So Tether's obviously been a magnet for controversy over the years due to not ever having a proper kind of audit or proof that they actually have 100% fiat reserves. And now they've just gone and updated their website and basically said, yeah, no, we don't. So they updated the section where it says that Tether is backed by 100% fiat. And now it reads, the backing may include other assets and receivables from loans made by Tether to third parties. Now, this just basically means that they're backing Tether, which, you know, is the USD stablecoin, with anything they can find. So, you know, anything that's worth something, which is a lot worse than just backing it one-to-one with some US dollars in a bank account. So it's really interesting to see that. I think it's been updated a couple of times, these terms, and they just keep updating it with more dodgy kind of black box stuff where you look at it and you're like, what is going on? Is this just kind of hot potato where they're like, oh, we had money in this bank account. Oh, we don't. We actually have these assets now, which can cover it if, you know, if we need to redeem it, which is fine. But I mean, they change it so much. There's so little transparency around that. It's kind of hard to believe that what anything they say. There's arguments to be made that because Tether is closely tied to Bitfinex, pretty much like, I'm pretty sure the same people are involved in both, that Bitfinex is a very big exchange. So obviously they've been around for a while. They've made a lot of money. just based on that, based on how much money they've made from trading fees, maybe they do have the money that's sitting there because they're so large. But I mean, I'm not convinced by that because they obviously use Tether instead of US dollars, actual like kind of fiat US dollars. They use Tether as the trading pairs on their exchange. So maybe they've made a lot of fees in Tether. So when you think about that, they've made the fees in Tether and then they need to redeem the Tether, but they don't actually have the money to back up the Tether. It becomes this house of cards. So I wish there was more transparency around this, but I guess what I see happening now is other stable coins eating into Tether, like Gemini's dollar and Circle USD and DAI, of course, and all the other stable coins that are eating into Tether's market cap and market share. So hopefully we can chip away at that until Tether's kind of very small so we can take away that systematic risk there. But yeah, it's just, I wish we had more transparency around this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Tether is like that that thing everybody knows smells rotten, and it just, I guess, keeps showing more and more. I guess at least they're not lying now. Like, if you think about it, they obviously were probably taking in these funds and then at a minimum, like lending them outright to earn interest on them. That seems to be what they were doing. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the assets are in crypto too. So they brought in the funds and then bought, say, Bitcoin with them. And, you know, hopefully that wasn't the case if they were doing it at the top, because now they would have a lot less than they were, although they're still claiming, I guess, you know, they have one-to-one backing or they're redeemable. It's just not in fiat. I guess I will say, like, Tether isn't the only one who's putting these funds to use. I mean, if you look at the USDC, which is the Coinbase and Circle stablecoin, if you look at the terms, they say that they're going to go out and earn interest on your deposits and that they have a right to that interest, right? So, I mean, these institutions are going to turn this into, you're essentially, in my opinion, going to see Coinbase kind of turn into a bank at a point. They're sitting on millions and millions of dollars worth of deposits. They're not going to let it just sit there and not earn interest. Like, at a minimum, they're going to take the interest on that. They're going to put it in a bank and they're going to earn interest on those deposits. So, obviously, I'm sure Tether's taking that up to a little bit more of extreme. I don't really mean to compare USDC and Tether because I think one's definitely more reputable than the other. But at the end of the day, if you don't have these funds, they're probably earning something off of them. What's scary is, I mean, Tether, I don't even think the market cap has dropped much on Tether. I think it's still like 2 billion market cap and still way up there. I think ninth on coin market cap or something like that. So for whatever reason, people aren't taking their funds out at a pace like they were when the a few months back when DAI was launching and getting hot. I guess maybe, I mean, at this point, it could just be a lot of money laundering happening with Tether and people are just, it's going to stick around for a while.
Yeah, I think it almost got to 3 billion market cap and then it's dropped down to 2 now. So whether that's just people redeeming their US dollars for Tether, you know, is another story, or whether it's just them going to a more reputable stable coin instead, you know, could be either thing. And one thing I did want to touch on as well was, I wouldn't go far as to say that they're conspiracy theories. It's more just theories around things like Bitfinex using Tether to prop up the price of crypto because they can just print as much Tether as they want. And for some reason, the market believes it's, you know, equal to one US dollar, even though there's been so much dodgy stuff going on. So maybe they've just used it to pump up the price of Bitcoin and wash trade and trade against their actual customers. I don't know. It does devolve into conspiracy theory territory quite quickly, but it is something to keep in mind. I wouldn't suggest giving it much credit because of the fact that there's no proof. There's just, I mean, wash trading happens across all exchanges pretty much, you know, and a lot of trading can look like wash trading, even though it's just bots and big market makers and things like that. So unless you're an expert on exchanges, I probably wouldn't go looking at it just because you might fall down in a conspiracy rabbit hole, especially a few Twitter accounts that talk about Tether a lot. They tend to put out these far-fetched theories. But, you know, maybe it's true. Like, I'm not saying that conspiracy theories don't turn out true sometimes, but it's best to not fall down that rabbit hole. So speaking of exchanges, we finally have some resolution around MT Gox's CEO, Mark Capelli. So he's actually been found guilty of manipulating exchange data. Now, I think a lot of people know about the Willybot that Mark ran on the exchange back in the day to make up for the hacks that were, that happened. So there are a lot of different hacks that stole Bitcoin out of MT Gox, which ended up making them insolvent. So Mark thought it would be a good idea to run a bot to be able to trade his way back to having as many Bitcoin as they lost to pay back their customers, basically. Now, obviously, this didn't work. MT Gox went completely bankrupt. It crashed and burned pretty hard. I think they lost up to 800,000 Bitcoin or something like that. Or they lost a lot, and then a lot of that was seized as well. So, yeah, he's gotten a suspended sentence of 2 years and 6 months. This basically means he won't be going to jail, but he needs to be a good boy for 4 years, so to speak. So, yeah, it's good to see some resolution around this. I think he's been quite remorseful as well. I don't think he's an actual criminal. I think that he tried his best to get out of a really shitty situation, but unfortunately, it was a crime what he did, and he's paying obviously the consequences of that. So yeah, it's a bittersweet resolution, I think.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised he didn't get any jail time for this. If you think about like all the manipulation and lost funds that went on, I guess it's because he's kind of owned up to it and all that stuff. And I guess one saving grace is I think recently a decent amount of the Bitcoin were found. And because the price has gone up so much since the Gox hack or collapse, a lot of people will be reimbursed their funds. But, you know, still people lost some. And of course, it crashed the price of Bitcoin at the time, which kind of caused market-wide losses and all this stuff. The thinking back to this still gives me, I guess, PTSD just thinking about everything that happened during that time. But I guess this is finally kind of a close to this chapter. It's been, let's see, 25 years now or whatever it's been since this kind of started taking place. So it's been a long journey as far as Gox goes, but you know, except for in the history books, I guess that'll be the last we kind of hear of this.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Gox seems to come back with a vengeance. Like we saw a few weeks ago, I'm not sure if I included it in the newsletter, the news that Brock Pierce, he's been around for a while. He was like kind of, I think it was the founder maybe, or the president of the Bitcoin Foundation back in the day. And the Bitcoin Foundation isn't the same thing as the Ethereum Foundation. It was kind of a fan-made thing, if you will. But yeah, he announced that he would bring back Gox, but then there was like all this news about how he's not really bringing back Gox and all this stuff. It's just weird, man. MT Gox just seems to come back all the time and just haunt us in our dreams, that exchange.
Yeah, that's very true. You never know, I guess. I don't know who in their right mind would go use a Gox exchange at this point, though, if it were revived.
Yeah, there's definitely much better alternatives now. I don't think anyone would be using it, to be honest. Sweet. So on to the project updates for the week. I don't think we've spoken about this before. DieCard. So DieCard is it's very similar to kind of the burner wallet and the XDAI burner wallet, in that you can set up a wallet in your browser and receive or send Ether and DAI very quickly. So DieCard hit mainnet this week. It's using state channel technology for payments. I think you can deposit up to $30 worth of ETH or DAI and start paying people basically instantly for a very, very, very low fee, or sometimes feeless, I think. You know, I saw that you put out a tweet saying, hey, tweet at me with your address and I'll send you 10 cents worth of DAI, which I thought was really cool. So yeah, it hit mainnet, awesome. And then we had another project as well come out called Crypto Store. This is using Plasma, Matic Network's implementation of Plasma instead of state channels. It does basically the same thing, but that was really cool as well. So we're getting all these different kind of payment rails on Ethereum, basically. Really easy to use wallets. It doesn't require you to download anything. You literally just load up a browser. So I thought that was really cool. So, you know, we now have Burner Wallet, DieCard, and Crypto Store all using different technology. Burner Wallet using a POA sidechain, DieCard using state channels, and Crypto Store using Plasma. It is worth noting that Crypto Store is currently only on a testnet. So you'd just be able to test it. You might be able to actually send any real DAI or ETH to anyone. But it just came out of nowhere, basically. And it just seems that this happens all the time in Ethereum. Someone will build something really, really cool, launch it out of nowhere, and then the community kind of falls in love with it. We saw this happen, especially with something like Uniswap, where, you know, Vitalik posted about this 3 years ago on Reddit, and then someone took this idea, ran with it, released it, and now Uniswap's become a kind of DeFi darling, which is really, really cool to see. So you've had more experience with the die card than I have because of the tweet. How did you find your experience with it, Eric?
Yeah, I've been playing with this even before it was kind of public and it was on the test net. It's really awesome. I mean, you explained it. We kind of have three of these options, kind of trying to accomplish the same thing, but in their own different styles. So yeah, we have, you know, this is very similar, or the die cards to me is very similar to the Burner Wallet. So the Burner Wallet is on the POA network, which is a layer two sidechain. And then this uses payment channels a lot like the Lightning Network does, right? So it's on mainnet. What's really cool about it is you can send ETH into it and it auto collateralizes your card into DAI. So that's the only step you have to do is send ETH in, and then all of a sudden you have DAI. I love the Burner Wallet, but there is kind of the extra step there of you have to convert DAI to XDAI. And that step doesn't have to happen on the DAI card. But it's really cool. I mean, very similar functionality. They were clearly inspired by the Burner Wallet. Kind of hope the two teams kind of come together and start hacking on this together to kind of make the UI more unified and all that stuff. But what's really neat about it is you can send DAI to someone that's never used it before, even if you don't know their address. So you can put like $5 and you hit link, and then anybody that clicks on that link, so obviously you would want to keep it private and send it to like a friend or a family member or whatever if you owe them a payment. And they click that link, and the second they click it, the funds are automatically sent over. So a lot of cool features. And like you mentioned, it's feeless. I mean, there's fees to open your DAI card to kind of initialize yourself into the channel. But if you get someone to send you DAI that's already in the channel, then you don't have to worry about that. So yeah, I mean, again, just these instant feeless DAI payment options, I guess we'll call them. I think this is what's really going to push Ethereum into the mainstream, right? Like, because to the user, it shows US dollars, and it's very easy onboarding and offboarding. So I'm pretty bullish on all of these ideas. And then the crypto stock, that one being on Plasma is cool. It's just cool to see all the different options we have out there. We talk a lot, you know, Bitcoin's putting all their eggs in one basket when it comes to Lightning. Ethereum's taking a different approach. I mean, there's so many layer two solutions. I mean, there's upwards of 20 or 30 different possibilities at this point. So it's really cool to kind of see the same idea take place on a bunch of these different options. And I'm sure we'll learn pros and cons of each.
Yeah, it's no secret that you're not a very big fan of the Lightning Network. I have my kind of bearish tendencies towards it as well, just because of all the problems with it. And I mean, I'm not to say the problems can't be worked out, but I just, as you said, I think that they're putting all their eggs in one basket and they're thinking that Lightning's going to be a panacea and that it's going to solve every issue. You know, I don't think it will. I think this is why I'm in Ethereum, right? We're in Ethereum basically, and why we follow it so closely. We love the experimentation happening. We love the fact that there's three different things now doing, you know, similar things, but in their own unique way. We're going to see what shakes out best, and then we're all just going to kind of, you know, gravitate towards that. Whereas with Lightning Network, it's just one thing, and they're just trying to make it fit into something that they want it to be. When it, from what I've seen and what I know about Lightning Network, it has so many issues with it that. And the issues are already, the issues come from the fact that Bitcoin is very hard to develop on as well, because it doesn't have a Turing complete scripting language like Ethereum does. So these things are much easier to spin up on Ethereum. So I completely sympathize with that. This is why we love Ethereum. So yeah, I think we're definitely going to settle on one or two major implementations of this, depending on what people find easier. I think it also comes down to a UI UX thing as well. So it could be a clunkier solution in the back end. But if the UI and UX abstract that away completely from the user, then they're just going to gravitate around that, you know, at the end of the day. So I definitely think DAI card is the leader here in this sort of thing. Burner Wallet was really cool, but there's just, as you said, there's too many steps for everyday people. I'm thinking like the noobs of the noobs, like people who, like my dad, for instance, who would never touch this sort of stuff. I think DAI card is probably the easiest solution for him at the moment, considering he knows how to use a web browser. That's all the prior knowledge you need. So yeah, and it doesn't require spinning up any extra software or anything like that at the end of the day. So I think that is the killer kind of app there in terms of usability for everyday users.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I will. So explaining dye is hard enough than explaining to someone, okay, well, then you got to go to this X dye thing. Like, it's just too much. Like, and I love, I mean, the Burner Wall clearly wins right now in user experience and user interface. And like, of course, they had the original concept too. That's why I was saying, I kind of hope these two teams maybe combine or work together. You know, it's good to have the multiple solutions because, you know, it just gives you options, right? And then CryptoStaw, which, by the way, can they please change that name? I love the product. I have no idea like what that name means, and it's also very hard to say. But anyways, they have a good UI on theirs too, and so it's just cool. Like, hopefully we get some collaboration as we test all these different concepts out. But I agree on the mainstream. Like, to me, DieCard just has less steps, so I could see it winning more in the mainstream. But you know, people enjoy user experience and UX too, and I've talked to the DieCard team a lot over at Connects, and they're aware they're missing some things in the UI that they need to add, like there's no transaction receipts and whatnot. And then they're also, or transaction history, not transaction receipts. And then they're also going to plan on building out the network too. So right now there's just one hub that they run. So the funds are non-custodial. So they never have control of that, but they could technically intercept payments. And this is another thing of using all these different solutions, right? Like the POAE network, it is a little bit more probably trustless than DieCard is at the moment. But then again, there's only like 21 essentially trusted authorities on the POA network. So I would never want to store a lot of funds there. So it's cool to kind of see the trade-offs and whatnot. And Connects is going to be adding multi-hop, multi-hub functionality to kind of take themselves out as a middleman there as well. But, you know, I guess I would caveat this entire discussion with, I wouldn't suggest putting a lot of funds in any of these, right? I would throw in a couple dollars to play around with them in their beta stages.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely not ready for mainstream. So don't put, you know, your life savings in it. Cool. So So really looking forward to seeing what shakes out of that. I'll move on to the next news now. So Gitcoin grants. So Gitcoin grants have announced another matching round for grant matching. So $50,000 committed to open source software. They're using what's called, I think, CLR matching. I can't remember what it stands for, but I know you've been more involved with this, Eric, with the team, especially with like the Gitcoin Torch a couple of weeks ago. So did you want to run us through what's happening with these Gitcoin grants?
Yeah, definitely. So this kind of, they had their matching period, let's see, a few weeks back, and ETHUB actually got a decent amount of matching from that, which was awesome. CLR stands for Capital Constrained Liberal Radicalism. Man, that's a mouthful to say. It was actually a paper, a concept written by Vitalik and Glenn Weil and a couple other people. And essentially what it breaks down to and how this Gitcoin matching works is, so the Ethereum Foundation has stepped up and said, we're going to put $50,000 in matching. And then the effort we've talked about a lot, which I kind of start on Twitter, the Gitcoin Torch, has been going on for a while now, is up to 14,000 DAI. And this is kind of a last call for the Torch, by the way. We're going to shut down the matching on Friday, actually. And Anthony and I are going to be on the Gitcoin like community live stream on Friday. So definitely come check us out. We're going to present a couple things from ETHUB. But anyway, so we have like 64,000 in matching pledge right now across the EF and the community Torch effort. How normal matching would work is like someone would go in and say, hey, I want to donate, you know, 1,000 DAI to ETHUB. And then maybe five people would go in and donate, say, $20 each to Connects, right? Well, normally matching, then you would get $1,000 matched to ETHUB and you would just get the $100 in total for Connects. CLR kind of takes a different approach. So they actually pay out more. It's very complicated, like, formula and system, but if you break it down very simply, they would end up matching more to the project that got the higher quantity of donations than the single large donation. So it kind of takes away like whale donating and matching and gives it more to what the community clearly thought should get more, right? Because in theory, if you had like 30 people give just what they could, maybe they were smaller to a single project versus one that just had a big whale donation. In theory, that project that got the 30 smaller donations, the community probably thinks that's a more valuable project. So it tries to spread out these matching funds in a very different way than normal. So long story short, the CLR matching round two on Gitcoin grants is open. So if you go out and you donate to your favorite project or projects now, that will be included in the matching round. So I believe it's running for 3 weeks. And at the end, the $64,000 in matching will be distributed to those teams.
Yeah, it's a really cool initiative. We talk a lot about funding and different funding mechanisms on the podcast and, you know, on Twitter in general. Of course, we have Moloch DAO, which we spoke about at the start of the podcast, and we've now got, you know, Gitcoin grants as well. And it's good to see this matching coming along, and then the Gitcoin Torch was awesome. There's just so much going on right now in terms of getting some more funding for the community. I think it's just going to grow from here. We all know that a lot of people in the community, especially core developers, are struggling because it's kind of that tragedy of the commons problem where a lot of people are building on top of Ethereum and able to raise money like that, especially through ICOs and, you know, different funding rounds. But the actual core developers building the protocols, you know, constantly underfunded, you know, and find that have to work a full-time job as well as doing, you know, core protocol stuff on the side, which definitely is not what we want. So it's great to see more funding initiatives come out. And if, you know, as Eric said, go to Gitcoin Grants, fund your favorite teams. You know, you don't have to send large amounts if you don't have a large amount of money to send. At the end of the day, you don't have to be a whale. Just, you know, donate whatever you can and know that you're helping, you know, secure the future of the Ethereum network, basically. And if you hold ETH, you know, maybe you're doing it for some selfish reasons as well. That's fine. We're all human. Maybe you want your ETH holdings to go up. This would be go a little bit of the way to doing that because they're building the protocol, making it better so that it may, you know, the price may go up in the future due to that. So I think it's great to kind of accept that it can be a selfish thing while being an unselfish thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of the CLR matching is kind of like you said, like one of the problems with funding public goods is people don't feel like their donation is going to make a difference, right? And what's cool about this right now is if you go out there and just throw, I don't know, $10 at your favorite project, like the matching is going to be way more than that, right? So your $10 might be matched up to 20 times, right? Depending on how this all shakes out at the end. So it's a good way to know that your money is going further than just your own single donation, which is one really cool aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, definitely get involved with that. Cool. So one other topic that we talk about a lot, especially on Twitter, is Ethereum nodes. Full nodes, archive nodes, light clients, all the nodes, everything. Everyone's always getting confused. And to be fair, the terminology is quite weird. So we, of course, have our page up on ETHub that explains the different types of nodes. I think a lot of the confusion comes from the Bitcoin side because there isn't actually a one-to-one equivalent and they have different naming for things. So I was reading that an Ethereum full node is equal to a Bitcoin archive node, but an Ethereum archive node is completely different because Ethereum has state, Bitcoin does not. It gets pretty technical if you look into these things. But my point is that it was, you know, we were arguing, debating about this on Twitter over the past few days, and then BitMEX Research comes out and launches an Ethereum node metrics website. So this was really cool because this website shows live data for Geth and Parity full and archival nodes, kind of uptime, you know, IO, things like that. So it was really timely that this came out. I think they've got a section that explains what commands that they're running as well. So if you click a little question mark on the website next to the node, it'll say, yep, we're running this. If you want to replicate that on your own machine and kind of replicate the results or the you know, check against their node to make sure that your node's working correctly as well. So yeah, it's a great website. I definitely suggest going to check it out. I think it's nodestats.org, but it's linked in the newsletter anyway.
Yeah, this is, oh man, node debates, right? This is like the never ending thing. Like it had went away and then Ofri disappeared off the face of the earth and like all the debate, because he was always kind of leading the fight back to all the FUD around nodes. And then for some reason it popped up the other day. I can't even remember why, but, and then again, people just go off to the races with nonsense without like looking into things, right? So it's nice to have a resource to point to. Yeah, like you said, they have Parity and Geth up there, archive and full and all that good stuff. And, you know, it's just like, yeah, to run a node, maybe you have to have a little bit of knowledge because it requires like command line interface and all this stuff, but it's really not that big of a deal. I mean, I've run nodes for years at this point on many different computers and I've never run into all these issues that people claim to have run into. Yeah, it might take a day or 2 days to get into sync and it takes up a little bit of hard drive space, but it's not the... It does not deserve the hoopla that it gets on Twitter. And I know it's used by people to kind of FUD Ethereum and all that. So it's probably never going to go away. But I guess this is also a good time for me to plug Avado. So I recently bought an Avado node, which basically comes as a plug and play node using Dapp node. So Dapp node basically just is trying to make running nodes easier. Like they put an interface on top of it. And Avato is building hardware to ship to you that's kind of made for nodes, and they put Dapnode on it. Anyways, I got one. I got the Avato i3, and I absolutely love it. I would suggest to anybody that's interested in running a node, and someday it looks like the Dapnode team is looking into interfaces for staking as well. So you would be able to transition this from a proof of work node to a proof of stake validator in node. So just because we're making the transition, you're not going to waste your purchase or anything like that. But I'm running a Parity full node, some test nets, status node, a swarm node, and like the CPU isn't that crazy. It's like an Intel i3, 8 gig RAM, 520 gig SSD. So it's a pretty lightweight computer. I mean, those are nice specs, but they're nothing crazy. The chain's only taking up like 167 gig and the computer is running fine. But anyways, it's really cool. I love this thing because you can just VPN into it. Wherever you are in the world, you can hook your MetaMask and your Augur and your My Crypto app or whatever you might want to, you can RPC into it. So big props to their team for kind of trying to make it so that people can run their own nodes just turnkey and nice and easily.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get my hands on one of those. I'm redoing a lot of my kit at the moment with my different nodes. I normally run both Parity and Geth nodes as well, not archival, just the full nodes. I'm just checking out the website now. It's pretty cool. They've got like a Ethereum Parity archive node, and they're showing kind of the chain data size. So it's 2.4 terabytes, but I think it's important for people to realize one key difference between archive and full nodes. An archive node is almost never needed by kind of any regular user. So the way I explain it to a lot of people is that an archive node lets you see kind of historical state. So imagine you wanted to know the balance of an account at block 4 million on the Ethereum network. Now, under most circumstances, you can look that up on a block explorer, which may use archive nodes, but they may also have a kind of, I think, state snapshots, which they can reference. But if you want to do this on your own kind of PC for, I don't know why you would want to do this. Maybe for just kind of getting various stats and metrics around the Ethereum network, or I don't know, kind of accounting reasons, maybe, not sure. But yeah, so it lets you view the balance at what your kind of Ether or token balance was at block 4 million. We're at block, 7.5 million almost now. So it's only required for those kind of historical things. It's not required, like a full node will tell you a lot of other data that that you need to know, especially out of the state anyway, your token balance, your Ether balance, your kind of smart contract data and all that sort of stuff. So, and a full node at the moment for Parity, according to node stats, is 170 gig and Geth is about 200 gig. Now, there's different settings as well that you can use to make that smaller and or to make it a little bit larger. So as I said, there's a little section, little question mark next to each one that says what they're using, what commands they're using to run these things, and you can replicate it on your own machine. So it's really cool to see BitMEX Research getting involved in this. So kudos to them. They've actually partnered with Token Analyst, another website, to put this together. So go check out the website. It's got a bunch of different data here, and they've actually got an explanation of what that kind of metric is, what PC specs they're running on, all stuff like that. So very great to see this. Cool. So just a quick shout out. So What's New in F2 is back from Ben Edgington this month. He took about a month hiatus. Unfortunately, he said it was due to just lots of work, and definitely there's lots of work to do in the ETH2 space. So it's good to see it back. Just a reminder to check out this awesome summary from Ben each week. We'll definitely include it in the newsletter. But yeah, it breaks down basically everything you need to know about ETH2, both technical and non-technical. It's if you want to keep up with ETH2 and you've only got a little bit of time, just read this summary basically.
Yeah, it's a great newsletter. It saves me a ton of time every week, like, or whenever it comes out. There's just so much to keep up on this space. So like anything that can do really good recaps and still get all the key points across are extremely valuable. So we should always keep shouting people out that are putting that stuff together.
Yeah, for sure. And if you don't want to miss it, go follow Ben on Twitter. He puts out some great tweets as well, because he's also working on ETH2 himself. So really cool to see. Now, we spoke about this last week, the DAI peg. So we spoke a lot about how there's a lot of inefficiencies within the kind of Maker CDP area, and how DAI is struggling to maintain its peg. I mentioned last week that the stability fee was raised to 3.5% to compensate for this, to encourage people to pay down their debts and to burn more DAI because there was too much supply, not enough demand, which means that DAI was losing its peg. And it was, I think it dipped to like 94 cents at one point, but it's hovering around 97, 98 at the moment. It did touch a dollar, went back to kind of parity, but I think, but the DAI supply didn't actually drop, since the stability fee was put in, since it was raised, sorry. So this shows me that there was some more demand for DAI for some reason. I think it was because the market just generally for ETH especially turned a little bit bullish when we went up a little bit, but that wasn't a result of the stability fee. So I don't know if there's been any news around raising this stability fee even further. I think that it will be raised because we're approaching the 100 mil DAI cap as well. So, whether that constrains the kind of demand as well, because there's going to be more demand and no one will be able to mint extra DAI, which means that DAI just goes back to a dollar anyway. There's different levers that can be pulled, of course. There's different reasons. I think I saw someone on Twitter. Yeah, I retweeted this where he asked a few of his friends why they weren't closing their CDPs. And there was a lot of different reasons. One was that they were just lazy and they couldn't be bothered. And another one was that they didn't care about the rate because 3.5% was still a lot better than what they could get from a bank. So, I think we mentioned this last week. I think you were talking about this, Eric, where you were saying that 3.5% isn't enough to get people to pay back a debt, especially because banks offer loans for way higher than that, personal loans. I think in Australia, for me to get a personal loan, it would be 12 to 15%. Now, that's quite insane. And that would be, obviously, there's benefits to that I don't need to put up a large amount of collateral, of course. But with opening a CDP, you need to put up 150% at least worth of ETH as collateral. It's just different models, different kind of levers that are being pulled. So I think we'll see another hike in the stability fee over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So I think like an hour ago, actually, there's a proposal now to raise it to 7.5%. So it seems like the maker community has realized that this hike isn't doing the job and they're likely, I guess, going to raise it again. I would assume it's going to get raised now that the proposal's out there. We talked about this and we kind of said, yeah, I don't think this is going to do it. It's such an inefficient niche market, right? Like a lot of people are just kind of opening CDPs to play with it. A lot of people probably open CDPs to buy ETH. They're lower, so they're okay not selling it even at 3.5% a year. It's just so interesting to watch this play out. I guess this is a shameless plug, by the way. We have Rune Christensen going to be on Into the Ether in a week, and there'll be a lot of discussion around this. So definitely tune into that. But I've even been thinking, like, if you're assuming that these rates are going to be volatile, it's a little bit of a chicken game between CDP holders too. Like who's going to close first, right? Like if you really don't want to close your CDP, you're probably fine paying 7.5% divided by 12, like over a month. It's not that bad. And if you think others are going to cave before you and close, and then the maker holders or voters are going to lower the fee again, and then you're golden, right? So there's so much game theory at play here too, and just being a new and inefficient market, like it's definitely not going to only be the stability fee that keeps the rate in check. Like I know that's really kind of the only mechanism they have at this point. I think one thing that's really going to help this is when the DAI savings rate comes online, because that is kind of a one-way system right now, and this will fix the two sides of the supply and demand of DAI. So I'm enjoying keeping an eye on it. I'm not a maker holder, so I'm not participating in any of these votes or anything, but it's very fun to kind of watch this all play out.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the DAI savings rate, because we're looking at the world as it is for Maker at the moment, and the DAI savings rate is going to go a long way to remediating a lot of these issues and making, as you said, balancing the supply demand side. Because, as we see at the moment, I mean, if you go on mkrtools.tools/governance/stability fee, you can actually see when the stability fee is kind of lowered and raised, the mints and burns. So it was lowered from 2.5% to 0.5% on 24th of December last year. And you can see a massive spike in the green candle, which is a lot of mints. So a lot of people drew DAI that day. And it remained at 0.5% until it went up to 1% in February, which wasn't anything happening there. But then it went up to 1.5% at the end of Feb, and there was a massive green spike of minting as well. So it's just weird, because you expect the minting to happen when it's lowered, not when it's raised. But I think you mentioned that it was because we were approaching the die sealing, and people wanted to get in before the sealing was reached and draw die before that happened. So it's interesting to see this actually, you know, charted out on MKR tools, which is really great. And then, you know, when it was raised to 3.5% just before that happened, there was a mass minting as well. Not as big as the other two minting, but there was more minting going on, which is just insane because you expected people to pay it back. And burns haven't actually happened at all. So I think it follows more the kind of market, the crypto market in general, not so much the stability fee from what I've noticed, because there are random spikes of minting and burning when the stability fee remain the same as well. So I'd like to chart that against kind of the ETH price and see, you know, if that's the cause of it, because I think that actually has a lot more to do with it than any kind of stability fee or other mechanisms that Maker has in play.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess like you said, we shouldn't really judge this until the full system is in, and that includes multi-collateral DAI and definitely the DAI savings rate. Once that goes in, if stability fee isn't kind of playing the immediate role that it needs to, that'll be interesting. But I do think that it'll become more balanced once that's in, and it definitely has to be, right? Like, people don't want to lend something that has very volatile lending rates. Like, people like fixed rate mortgages, right? It just is what it is. They like to know the payment schedules and what it's going to look like. And you can't have just your loan going wildly up and down in payment rates.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm looking forward to seeing multi-collateral DAI and the DAI savings rate be implemented, because Maker at the moment, as much as, you know, as much ETH as it's sucked into it, over 2% at the moment, as much people are talking about it, I think it's pretty much the most popular project on Ethereum. It's still just a kind of, I don't want to call it a glorified proof of concept, but it's not a feature complete system yet. It is definitely a very big experiment, just like most things in this space. The governance system as well is an experiment. You know, we've spoken about getting people to vote on these things and getting voter turnout. I think there were some stats around it where there was a very low number of Maker holders came out to vote on a proposal, and it was a couple of whales basically. So, you know, we've spoken about on-chain governance before and how we think that we need to create something worth governing before people will come out of the woodwork to vote on these sorts of things. We also don't believe that one coin should equal one vote, but I mean, it's very easy to argue the opposite as well, to say, well, you know, people that hold a large amount aren't going to act in the worst interest of the system. But of course, that's not always the case, because the worst interest of the system, you know, best and worst interests are different for the rich and you know, normal people. So yeah, it's interesting. The governance aspect of Maker is definitely something that isn't talked about enough, that I would love more kind of research into. Oh, and a quick plug, I put it in the newsletter. Matteo from The Block did an awesome breakdown of the Maker governance call, you know, dissecting everything that was spoken about, putting different metrics to it, putting his own little spin on it and opinion in it. You know, it's just a great article. So definitely go check that out. The read of the week. I think he's going to be doing it every week, which is awesome, because we do need more of a spotlight on the Maker governance system. And the calls are quite dense. You know, the article itself, to be fair, is quite dense as well. It's a long read. But if you're interested in following along, I definitely recommend reading that instead of listening to the calls, because the calls can be a bit, can drag a bit, obviously, because people go back and forth. There's not a lot of supporting data immediately there. And you can't just kind of, you can watch at your own pace, but it's different when you're reading something. I think a lot of people prefer to read, because it's faster as well. Cool. So thank you everyone for tuning in again. That is it for this week. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, definitely go to ethhub.substack.com to subscribe and check out all the links to everything we've talked about this week. You're listening to the podcast, but if you haven't subscribed yet, go to podcast.ethhub.io and subscribe there, and we'll catch you all next week. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethhub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.